This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is British theater and film star Alec Guinness. Guinness is a very versatile actor who has portrayed a remarkable assortment of characters. In fact, in the film comedy Kind Hearts and Coronets, he plays 8 roles, an entire family. John Gielgud gave Guinness his first big break, casting him as Osric in a 1934 production of Hamlet, which Gielgud starred in and directed. For the next 10 years, Guinness performed on stage in the classics, plays by Shakespeare, Chekhov, and Shaw. When World War II ended, Guinness started making movies. After Kind Hearts and Coronets established his gifts as a comic actor, the Ealing Studios built several comedies around him, including The Man in the White Suit, The Lavender Hill Mob, and The Lady Killers. Guinness was also recognized as a great dramatic actor and won an Academy Award for his starring role in the 1957 World War II film Bridge on the River Kwai. Young filmgoers know him best as Obi-Ben Kenobi in the Star Wars trilogy. Alec Guinness's honors include a special 1980 Academy Award for advancing the art of screen acting through a host of memorable and distinguished performances, and in 1959 he was knighted by the Queen of England. Alec Guinness shares some of his memories in his book Blessings in Disguise, published by Knopf. I asked Alec Guinness if he thinks the way he started his acting career, performing in theater classics, is the best way to start.
I don't know about nowadays, but in the England of 40-something years ago, 50 years ago, yes, it was, I think. I mean, there were some great, great classical actors around. And the classics taught you how to speak and how to keep still and present yourself in that way. I think those are still admirable virtues to have, if you have them. But they also need to be broken through, you know, with more modern work.
How to speak and how to keep still. The speak, I understand. Explain the keep still.
Well, there's so many young actors I admire tremendously, but I've also seen so many young actors who fidget and distract and don't know where the focus of an audience's attention and focus should be. And if they fumble, scratch themselves, twitch, you know, they're drawing attention to themselves, but to no great advantage of anyone else.
Your first mentors were John Gielgud and Tyrone Guthrie. They both directed you in your early work. You describe them in your book as the two people who did the most to liberate English theater. Liberate them from what?
A kind of fustian. The drawing room comedy with the soubrette and the funny maid and the... not that they were writers, but they sought theatre elsewhere, and they brought over, Gielgud brought over foreign directors, foreign designers. Guthrie was very concerned that the theatre shouldn't be, English theatre shouldn't be localised in London, that it should reach the provinces, and he did a tremendous amount to, in that way, of spreading theatre, and of course... later was responsible for about 5 or 6 open stage theatres, starting with the one in Toronto, Stratford, Ontario.
Gielgud and Tyrone Guthrie directed your early performances. It sounds as if they were absolutely complementary in their approach to directing. Can you describe the differences between the two?
Well, I think Gielgud was a tremendous disciplinarian and very impatient. Impatient with the young people who couldn't do what he wanted. He was 10 years older than me, for instance, and at the height of his romantic appeal and excitement at that time. So you could become very inhibited if you were young and nervous and tentative. And then to kind of do a year with him, and he was absolutely, he wouldn't tolerate any sloppy speech. And then move to Guthrie, who... was wonderful with the young and encouraged the young, and it didn't matter. Do, you know, let yourself go, and was rather mean with the middle-aged and the elderly or the successful. He wanted a discipline of another sort, but it was a very good balance to have this hard line of Gielgud's and then this swift, free line of Guthrie's.
Do you remember any lasting advice that you got in your early years of acting about enunciation or breathing or speaking lines?
Oh, many, I think. But I think all advice is something to discard sooner or later. When I first used to go and have... I was trying to get a scholarship to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, and I went to Martita Hunt, who was an actress, and she formed my taste, I think, a great deal. And when she heard me reading, one of the kind of little rule of thumb that she gave me was, she said, you know, for heaven's sake, never put the emphasis on an adjective unless you have to, or an adverb. Go straight for the verb, because that is the driving force of the sentence. Now, it doesn't mean to say that every time you speak a verb, you've got to plug it. But it did form, I think, the basis of my own appreciation of speaking, of listening to people. And I hear nowadays so much false emphasis, not just in the theatre, in fact, not so much in the theatre, as on railway stations when they tell you, you know, they say that in England, you know, they'll say the train for such and such a place will leave from platform some. And you think, was there any doubt about it? And you get confused instead of them just saying the train for such and such a place will leave at such and such a time. And
there's a story that you tell in your book about a role you were playing and you'd lost the laugh in it, and Edith Evans, who was also appearing in it, gave you some advice on what to do to get the laugh back. Can you tell us about that?
It was in The Seagull, and Edith Evans was playing the lead, and I took over a small part, having been playing an even smaller one, and on my first time I played it, it got, on my exit, it got a tremendous round of applause and a big laugh, and I was cock-a-hoop with myself over that. And I happened to look around, Edith Evans was sitting in the wings, and she kind of nodded and half-smiled. And then for the next two or three performances, I went on, nothing happened at all. I didn't get the laugh, and I didn't know what I'd done. She beckoned me, and she said, you've lost that laugh. And I said, yes, what am I doing? And she said, well, because you didn't know how you got it in the first place. And now you're striving, and you're trying too hard. And she said, now just relax on it, and the next time it comes, because it will come again, because that's your natural bent, just note what you were feeling inside. Don't note some exterior thing. Just find afterwards, think, now what was I actually going through inside? And she said, it'll take you about a week. And she was dead right. 1 week later, I didn't know what happened. I got the laugh again, and it never left me again. But I knew that I had a kind of relaxation which I hadn't achieved before.
Did you go through a period when you were starting out of studying the gestures of every stranger who you met, so you'd acquire all these, you'd acquire a whole gallery of gestures and speaking styles that you could use in roles?
Well, I certainly used to follow people in the street thinking I could, I mean, when I was a very impoverished student, thinking that I could learn something from the way they walked or feel I knew something about them, and very consciously did that sort of thing. Occasionally now I will still, if something catches my eye, but not for immediate use, and I like to forget them so that if I do use something that I've observed, I don't know where it's come from. It's from way, way back. I've rather scraped the bottom of the barrel now.
I was thinking that your early period on the stage must have really played havoc with your ego. Your first acting teacher told you that you weren't any good. She wanted to give you back your money and send you on your way. At your first audition at the Old Vic, the director yelled for you to get off stage. And I wonder what you had or what kind of passion for theater that you had that kept you going.
I don't know. It's very difficult. Looking back with hindsight, I suppose I was very obstinate. And in my rather shy way, certainly in those days, I suppose I was very determined that I wasn't going to take no from people who weren't necessarily first class. And I think this is kind of quite good. I mean, it's a tough profession. There's enormous unemployment, anyway, in my country. And I think, without being too aggressive, an actor needs, when he's very young, to have that sort of thing. I'll starve, but I'm going to do it.
My guest is Alec Guinness. He's written a new memoir. It's titled Blessings in Disguise. You joined the Navy in World War II. And I wonder if it gave you any ideas about acting, because you were exposed to so many different kinds of people and different experiences and different cultures as you sailed around the world.
Well, I think part of the title of my rather odd book, Blessings in Disguise, lies in my naval experience, insofar as if it hadn't been for the war, and God knows, you know, we can do without wars, I would no doubt have stayed in the West End Theatre in England. I would have moved with many delightful people, pretty frivolous, pretty light-headed, always concerned about what was next happening in the theatre. Well, the war came as literally a bombshell. I was just starting on what looked like a promising career, so it was a bit wretched to say goodbye to that. But it moved me for the next few years among people whom I was unlikely to meet, not from the point of view of observing them or what they were like, but getting to know men on the lower decks, and then later on I became an officer, and realizing that the world wasn't just theater. On the other hand, I had to perform as such, and I never knew what I was doing quite as a naval officer, and I was in command of a little ship built here in Quincy Yard in Boston. And so I really acted being a naval officer, or my idea of what a naval officer might be like. And I've always maintained that was the best performance I've given. I mean, it wasn't a very impressive one. It was a very very junior thing, but it was a long run.
Did having the uniform make it even more like playing a part?
Oh, of course, yes. I dressed up as it.
Several years after the war, you started making movies. Did you say to yourself, I want to do movies now?
No, it wasn't that. I'd never been particularly interested in movies. I don't know why. I'd loved going to them, but I'd never sort of thought of myself as going into movies. I thought I probably hadn't got the right face, or there was always a lot of talk about photogenic qualities and so on. But at the very beginning of the war, I had written a stage adaptation of Great Expectations, which was performed, and I was in it. And that was seen by David Lean and Ronald Neame, who were working together then. And at the end of the war, 1945, beginning of 46, they were going to make a film of Great Expectations, and they remembered seeing me, and I was still in the Navy when they contacted me, saying, you know, would you like to come and play that part you played on the stage on film? And I'd always rather thought, if ever I do a film, the first one must be something that I've already played in the theatre, so at least I know what I'm at so far as the character's concerned. Then I can put myself in the hands of technicians. And that's what happened.
What was your reaction when the first time you saw yourself in a leading role in a movie?
Well, I don't know. I think I was rather sick. I would have seen the dailies, as they're called. We call them the rushes in England, of Great Expectations, and was horrified at what I saw. But David Lean was very keen that his actors should see the rushes. So for the first few films I made, I always did. And I suppose I learned something. I learned not to fidget or twitch or some little mannerism which was creeping in. Now, or for many years now, I never look at them. I mean, I never look at the dailies.
You say you were horrified at the beginning when you looked
horrified.
At them. What horrified you?
Oh, I couldn't believe. It was something nauseating up there. I couldn't bear it.
You think that's a typical reaction that people have when they see themselves, especially if they're used to acting on stage?
Well, I have some people. I've seen them watching themselves, and I've seen their faces suffused with pleasure.
In 1949, you made the movie Kind Hearts and Coronets, and you played eight roles. I think it was eight. You played an entire family in it. It's a really funny movie. Whose idea was it for you to play all those roles? How did that come about?
Robert Hamer, who directed it, who was a brilliant creature, alas, dead, invited me to play two of them, victims in it, I mean, two of the family. And I was on holiday in France, and I read the script lying on a beach, and I laughed within two pages of it out loud, hurried through the rest of the script, and thought, but it's ridiculous to play two. Either play one, which I can understand, or the whole lot. So I went to the post office and sent off a telegram and saying, you know, love the script, but how about me trying to play all eight? Which I, there could be a reason for a family likeness. And to my joy and delight, they said, yes, fine, try it.
You did The Bridge on the River Kwai in 1957. Did you know as soon as you read the script you wanted to do the role?
No, not at all. The first script I read, I didn't care for at all. I thought it was not terribly good, and I turned it down. They didn't want me in the first place, that I found out as I started to film it. They wanted either Charles Laughton or Noel Coward, I believe. However, for various reasons, which I don't know, anyway, it came my way, and I said, I really don't quite see it. And the script was rewritten, not on my account, let me hasten to say, but it was, I think, David Lean, who directed it, thought there's a lot wrong with this, and it was rewritten. And when it was rewritten, you know, Sam Spiegel easily persuaded me to play it, although I'm not sure that I ever quite believed in the part.
What? Why not? What gave you doubts?
Well, he's such a blinkered man, you know, he's in such a narrow focus on life. I find it hard to be sympathetic with him. There are people like that, of course, but it didn't make for easy playing.
Do you feel you have to be sympathetic with a role in order to do a good job in it?
No, not sympathetic, but you have to have some sort of empathy of saying, well, I can understand that man, and, you know, that could be me or something. And I didn't quite feel that with Colonel Nicholson.
Did you get offered a lot of psycho colonel roles after Bridge of the River?
Every time. I mean, when I did a film called The Man in the White Suit, which was about a young scientist who invented an unbreakable thread, then the script started, and it was fairly successful. The scripts started coming in, all of which were about indestructible cars, indestructible something, you know, cliche things. When, after The Bridge on the River Kwai, I never stopped having scripts about dotty colonels or slightly mad service people. After Star Wars, there have been, I don't say the scripts have come in, but there have been suggestions. Oh, I've got an idea about this kind of wise old guy who does a, you know. And I always like something new, not going back on the last one.
So you've intentionally turned those down so
absolutely
that you don't build
deliberately.
You were knighted in 1959. How do you find out you're going to be knighted? Do they call you up?
A letter from the Prime Minister, in my case.
Do you like to be called Sir Alec or Sir Alec Guinness?
Well, I mean, this was all about, this is about 25, 27 years ago now. I've rather got used to people who don't know me saying Sir Alec. Ordinarily, I just like to be called by my Christian name with no accolade in front of it.
Do people make any presumptions about what a knighted person is going to be like? And I'm thinking even of a story that you tell in your book about Ernie Kovacs when you were working together on Our Man in Havana, and he thought that all I think Gielgud was in the movie too. And
no, he wasn't. Coward was,
yeah. And he thought that all of the sirs were going to be really stodgy.
And Carol Reed, of course, had been knighted. Yes, he thought we were all going to be toffee-nosed but he found that we were the ones he kind of got on with.
A role that you almost turned down, the way I understand it, was the role of Obi-Ben Kenobi in Star Wars. What you saw the script first?
Yes, I don't know. I've heard this before. There was no question of me turning it down. I was doing a film in Hollywood, Murder by Death, and I think it was about the last day of shooting of my work on it, and suddenly there was this script on my makeup table, and I saw that it was George Lucas, who had made American Graffiti by that time, but I had to rush off and work. And I said to various people, tell me what you know about George Lucas. And they all said, well, you know, that's a real filmmaker there, although he hadn't done anything tremendous. Got back, saw that the script was science fiction. I mean, I went back with enthusiasm because it was George Lucas, saw it was science fiction and thought, well, that's not for me. I mean, I'm not that sort of... But I bet, because it's Lucas, I better read a few pages and see what it's about. And I found myself turning the pages with alacrity. I didn't think the dialogue was very good. In fact, I thought it was rather bad. But the story held me. And so when I'd finished it, I contacted Lucas. We had lunch next day, and I was very impressed by him. He was very quiet and very sensible. And I indicated, yes, I'd love to do it. I've never turned it down at all.
It's the first movie you got into a laser beam fight with somebody.
And the last, I hope.
Was that a challenging sequence for you to...
No, but I mean, it was challenging insofar as that because of the technical involvement of these swords, which had electric batteries to revolve them to catch the light in the handle, you meant that they must never touch. So to go through a fight... in which the swords never touch, or, you know, always have to miss by half an inch or an inch. That was the strain of it. Nothing physical other than restraining oneself.
You die in the first movie. Did you expect that you'd actually still be returning, nevertheless, for sequels?
No, I suggested that I should die when I did, and that I should be removed from the film, because, I mean, I can say it now, I didn't dare at the time, I thought that the part which went on to the end of the film deteriorated and was less interesting. And I thought, if I can go out rather spectacularly, that's all right, but I don't want to fizzle out.
How come you never moved for good to Hollywood to have more access to the American film industry?
I've never wanted to. I mean, I'm married. My wife... I enjoy living in my own little neck of the woods in southern England. And why should I drag my wife away from what she loves? I mean, we've been married for nearly 50 years. And she's very much a country woman. I mean, she enjoys being in the country, hates being in cities. I mean, she enjoys having animals around her and this, that, and the other. And our life is a mutual life. I didn't want to impose anything on her. At all.
You've also never really given up the stage.
No. I like to have the theatre there as a sort of background to my life.
Do you consider yourself to be one of the actors, I'm thinking here, one of the Gielgud, Richardson, Olivier actors?
No, I'm not in the same class. That doesn't worry me. I've never tried to be. I'm my own man, which may not be very impressive, but it's the best I can do. I'm happy to admire them and indeed many others. But I'm about, as I said, about 10 years younger than that particular brilliant and strange group of actors. And therefore, they're always, you know, when you're 20, you see those other people up there at 30 or in their 30s or something. That's the sort of, it's possible. And they remain always above you.
Some actors feel that who they are at the moment depends on what role they're playing. And I wonder if you've ever experienced that in your career, if you feel that your personality is ever affected by or perhaps even confused with the role that you're working on?
Not totally. But when I do know that when I'm working on a part, if the part is one which attracts me or has caught my imagination, idle moments of the day, lying in a bath, going for a walk by myself, I will assume that new personality I'm trying to find to perform. I don't like people to witness that. I hope not to carry it into the home. My wife says that now and then she didn't like it when I was playing Hitler at all. She didn't like the personality that was, unconsciously by me, kind of beginning to emerge. Now and then, absolutely unknown to me. And there were one or two other parts which she liked. She said, oh, I like him around the place. I wasn't conscious that I was doing that. I wouldn't set about doing it, but I do know that that process does take place, yes.
Has your approach to doing a role changed?
To actually how I set about it? The work takes me longer now. It takes me longer to learn. I mean, understandably. I don't think the actual approach is very different. I'm maybe a bit more relaxed and serious. I don't mean serious, gloomy serious. I mean go into things a little bit more than I did when I was young, when I just sort of took it on the wing.
In your memoir, you wrote that you used to have stage nightmares. Do you still have nightmares?
Now and then, yes. It's always something quite, quite silly.
Are there recurring themes to these nightmares?
Oh, there's always the inadequate one, that you don't know the lines, you've got into the wrong clothes, or you're unzipped if you're a man. You suddenly don't recognize the other actors, even turning up in the wrong theater.
Have any of those things ever actually happened?
No, no.
You've written about this constant conflict that you've had on the one hand, being equally repelled and attracted by the spotlight, is the way you said it. So you think you found your balance?
No, it'll never be a real balance. It'll always be shifting from one foot to the other, I suspect.
I want to thank you so much for sharing some of your time with us. No. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for asking me.
My guest has been actor Alec Guinness. He's written a memoir. It's titled Blessings in Disguise, and it's published by Knopf. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Jay Goldman and Ron Barron. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Sallet is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview or for a listing of other Fresh Air programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4892. The number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.